In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time, the Roast of Tom Brady, a Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for the Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet? Well then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.
Going for your first ever run around the park. Literally running errands all over town. Running for the finish line and your personal best. If you run, you're a runner. Find the shoes and clothes to run your way at newbalance.com/running. New Balance. Run your way.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. Headlines have been made recently by proposed changes to the Treasure Act in England, Wales and Northern Ireland, which would see more historical and archaeological artefacts defined as treasure and could help museums to acquire more important items. Lord Parkinson is a British Conservative member of the House of Lords who currently serves as Parliamentary Undersecretary of State for Arts and Heritage in the UK. He spoke to Matt Elton about the thinking behind the proposals and some of the issues facing heritage in the UK.
So I'm joined today by Lord Parkinson, Parliamentary Undersecretary of State for Arts and Heritage, to talk through some of the recent developments, I suppose, in the heritage sector. First of all, we should talk about the changes to the Treasure Act here in England, Wales and Northern Ireland, and we'll get on to the specifics in a minute. For people who might not have heard, what's changed and what does it mean?
Well, the Treasure Act has been around for just over 25 years. We celebrated its 25th anniversary last year. I love an anniversary as Heritage Minister. And in that time, it has saved hundreds of objects for museums and public collections around the country. But the definition is quite specific at the moment of what constitutes treasure. Items have to be a precious metal, and they have to be over 300 years old. And that means that some items, like the Roman helmet that was found in Crosby Garrett in Cumbria, which are made of other metals, fall through the net. And we want to make sure there's been such an increase in metal detecting, thanks, you know, to TV programmes and the great coverage that people's discoveries always get. We want to make sure that the items that people find, you know, are covered by that definition so that they can be saved for museums and collections around the country. So we are changing or proposing to change the definition. We've laid it before Parliament and both houses will have the chance to say whether they agree. But our proposal is to bring it down to 200 years to say that items could be made of any type of metal, but also to bring in a new significance test. So if an item is significant because it sheds particular light on an individual or a particular event from the past, then it could be saved that way. And one of the lovely things about the treasure process is often items end up in museums or collections very close to where they were found, which means that the people that found them, you know, can be part of that story and, you know, see it proudly on display, inspiring people in their hometowns and villages.
So one of the hopes for this change, this kind of proposed change, is that artefacts will end up in museums rather than in private collections. Is that right?
That's right, yes. At the moment, you know, if they don't meet the criteria, then they can be sold on the open market. And sometimes private collectors very generously lend items to museums, but there's no, you know, automatic process for that happening. If they're defined as treasure, then museums get the opportunity to acquire them. And the people that find them and the landowners are eligible for a reward. So they're compensated for the discovery they've made, but they end up in a museum where they can inspire and educate people for generations to come.
Perhaps you can talk us through some of the reasons behind this proposed change. Is it something that people have been calling for, groups have been calling for?
Yes, we did a consultation on it. And as I say, there have been some cases like the Roman helmet at Crosby Garrett. I went to go and visit Chelmsford Museum. They've got a wonderful little Roman figurine there, the Birrus Britannicus. It's a native Briton from the time of the Roman occupation, wearing what they describe as a sort of an early duffel coat. He's wearing this cloak that tells you a lot about the weather in the UK at the time, the fashion, the craftsmanship, but also the way that the Romans were taken by us. They obviously wanted to keep warm in the British Isles, but they exported that throughout the Roman Empire. Now, that, again, was made of a base metal, so it didn't count as treasure. It was luckily saved through another mechanism, the export bar process, so it's ended up on public display only about 2 or 3 miles from where it was found in Essex. But we want to make sure that items like that can definitely be covered so that they can inspire people.
So the hope is, by having a more comprehensive definition of what counts as treasure, local communities and, I suppose, the nations as a whole will have a greater understanding of their history through these artefacts.
Absolutely, yeah.
At the start, I sort of specified that this was only parts of the UK. Can you just talk us through which parts it applies to, when it, if it goes through, and which parts it doesn't and why not?
Yes, this is separate in Scotland. There's a separate law there because the ancient laws of treasure trove are aligned differently in Scotland and predate the Treasure Act. So this is a change for England and Wales. There's also a slightly different process, which is rather complicated for Church of England land. But we think that the changes here will mean hundreds of items a year being covered by the new definition. And of course, we'll see how the process goes and see whether there's a case for further widening it to other materials in due course. But we want to make sure that the scheme runs well. The British Museum and the National Museum Wales help us run the Portable Antiquities Scheme. They do that brilliantly. So we've got to make sure that they and the Treasure Valuation Committee, who work out how much items approximately are worth, are able to continue processing the work as they've been brilliantly doing for the past quarter of a century.
Under the proposed changes, how will the decision-making process work in terms of what gets labelled treasure? Who will be involved in that process?
It's a coroner, again, for sort of historic reasons of treasure trove. So if an item is found, then a coroner determines whether it is definition, whether it counts as treasure under the definitions under the Treasure Act. And if it is, then museums get first dibs on acquiring it, and the Treasure Valuation Committee meet and they work out the value and how the finder and the landowner on whose land it was found, how they can be recompensed for it, and then work out how much this needs to be sold at. Often the items are, you know, only a few hundred pounds, so easily acquired by local museums. You know, they can be quite small. The value of the metal can be quite low, but the value, the uniqueness of these fascinating items is really beyond financial compare.
And is the funding of these proposals a consideration? How will the money be sorted in terms of how this will work?
Well, that's for museums to fundraise and through their acquisition budgets. And often there are, you know, private donors and grant-making bodies and philanthropic organisations who generously support the acquisition. And often, because of the publicity that items get when they're found, it's a great part of the fundraising and enthusing of the local community to make sure that museums are able to keep them.
The holidays have arrived early with Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale. Upgrading window coverings can be a minor project with a major impact. Blinds.com makes it easy and affordable. Browse premium blinds, shades, shutters. We have your patio covered too. And get unlimited window treatments installed for one low cost. Free shipping and Blinds.com's 100% satisfaction guarantee. Shop Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale now. Save up to 45% plus premium doorbusters. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet? Well then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.
We're talking right at the start of March. For people who might not be aware of how this works in terms of the parliamentary process, what has to happen between now and these proposals' next step, I suppose?
Well, it's secondary legislation, so we've laid it before Parliament. Parliament has the opportunity to have a debate on it in both houses if it wants. If the houses agree, then that becomes law under the Treasure Act. If Parliament wants to tweak it in any way, then they've got the opportunity, and obviously I'll be at hand in the Lords to debate it if they wish to. But I think there's, you know, I've been speaking to people in both houses. There's a all-party group for archaeology. I've been speaking to colleagues at the British Museum and some representatives of metal detectorists. So I think this follows the consultation that we did. We know that there's support for the change. I know some people would like us to go even further and cover sort of wooden and terracotta items and so on. And we're open to see how that works and see how the Act should be extended further in the future. But what we want to do is make these small but important changes about the age, the type of metal, and the significance test, which is probably the most important of the changes, and we think that'll bring many more items in, but allow the process that's been working very well to continue.
So it's sort of sounding out these changes and then potentially making more in the future.
Yeah.
if it goes well.
Yeah.
There was a report earlier this week that some museums are finding it difficult to be able to store or display the sheer volume of artefacts that they have in their collections. Do you have any sort of concerns about this adding to that sheer volume?
Well, yes. I mean, museums have, you know, very often what you see on display is only a fraction of their collection. And some museums are limited in law from deaccessioning items. They have to hold on to them for a future because, of course, the, you know, questions of what is interesting change. You know, the items that, you know, often sort of put away in the storeroom, but then as we're sort of talking about neglected histories, they shed a new light. So it's important that they're held on to, and that curators are able to sort of bring them out. Lots of museums, of course, lend items that aren't on display, and that's really important. You know, from our big national institutions, but small ones as well, generously lend them on rotation around the UK and indeed around the world. And you know, we support that through indemnity and insurance to make sure items can be transported. But you know, we talk to museums. Obviously, we have a direct relationship with a handful of museums who are the national institutions who are arm's length bodies for the department. And so we talk to them about the storage space that they have. But we also have schemes like the Museums Estates and Development Fund, which and the DCMS fund with the Wolfson Foundation, which help give grants to museums so that they can look at the bricks and mortar of their buildings, make sure that they're able to store things adequately, but also make sure that their buildings are accessible, that everybody can get in and see them. And often sometimes solve that problem of storage that is also display, so that you don't have to sort of keep things away from the public eye when you're cataloguing them and archiving them and keeping them for the future.
There's sometimes concern expressed in the archaeology sector that by focusing on the sort of monetary or financial value of these objects, it diverts attention away from their archaeological or historical worth. What would you say to those concerns?
Yes, I mean, twice now I've had the privilege of going to the launch of the annual treasure report at the British Museum, which is wonderful because you meet the people who found these objects, and they talk about their incredible pride at being the first human being to set eyes on this for 2,000 years. And, you know, it doesn't matter, you know, how much it's worth. It just immediately takes you back to, well, who dropped this? Who lost it? You know, this item of jewellery, this piece of coin, this clasp that was on somebody's cloak, it's, you know, it immediately conjures up images of how this item, you know, came to be buried under the ground. So it's wonderful meeting the detectorists who found them and seeing their pride at these items going on display. So yeah, sometimes they're lucky and they have a financial worth, but I think people aren't doing it to make money. They're doing it for the discovery and the chance of being that, you know, lucky first human being to hold this item.
One of the sort of more dark sides of archaeology, which I think emerged particularly during and after the pandemic lockdowns, was night hawking, which is when people sort of illegally, often at night time, go out with metal detectors and they find and keep objects. Has that been factored into this? Is that a concern?
Yeah, well, as I say, the vast majority of treasure finds are made by metal detectorists, and the vast majority of metal detectorists know what the law is. It's a criminal offence not to report something that is treasure. So, you know, there's a risk to people in flouting the law, as well as it, you know, being the wrong thing to do. These items, you know, are wonderful and should be shared with a wide audience. Lots of metal detectorists are part of clubs, which is great, because that means that, you know, they're part of a support network of, you know, explaining how the scheme works, understanding the portable antiquity scheme, and knowing where to find your local fines liaison officer so you can report it. And so we're grateful to all the detectorists who find things, report them, and, you know, then have the pride at the end of the process of seeing them on display. And of course, they should get the credit. Museums often like to tell the story of how things were found and who by. So it's great that there's this, you know, enthusiasm for people to get out there and help discover the history that's below us all.
I mean, as Heritage Minister, do you have a particular favourite heritage site or an aspect of history that particularly appeals to you?
Well, I'm a history graduate, so I feel really, really lucky to be the Heritage Minister. What's so wonderful is, you know, you get to jump around the country, jump around different eras, which is great. I'm from the Northeast, so, you know, the first historic sites I visited, I mean, I'm from Whitley Bay, so my nearest English heritage site is Tynemouth Priory, which is, you know, wonderful. I sort of, you know, as a child, you know, from tobogganing down the moat when it snowed to sort of exploring the monastery and the sort of the garrison there. I've been delighted to see Seton Delaval Hall, which I obviously visited as a child. That's been, you know, restored after the terrible, you know, fire that it suffered, you know, many years ago. And the National Trust have done some great work. I'm looking forward to going back and seeing that. But yeah, it's a real privilege. I've, you know, been proud to fly the flag for Northumberland as we celebrated the 1,900th anniversary of Hadrian's Wall, which is, you know, brilliant. You know, it's a, you know, gets so many visitors, not just to the rural bits of the wall in the county, but, you know, the bits that run through Newcastle city centre. You can go and visit a Roman temple that's just at the end of a residential street in the west end of Newcastle, and that's incredible that this history is around us. And the root of the wall goes under petrol stations and schools, and, you know, there's history all around us. And I think that incredible anniversary has been a great opportunity to engage the local community who just live right next to it.
We've talked a bit about funding already in this interview. There's been a lot of news in recent years about funding cuts across the whole range of sectors. Do you think that Heritage in Britain is currently underfunded? And what are your funding plans for the coming years, I suppose?
Well, obviously, during the pandemic, we stood by our heritage and cultural venues across the country. We provided more than £1.5 billion of support through the Cultural Recovery Fund, because, you know, so many of the sites depend on ticket sales and visits, and the gift shop, always exit through the gift shop. It's such an important thing. And, of course, suddenly, because of COVID, that just stopped overnight. So the government stepped in to make sure that all those sites were able to continue and welcome people back as soon as that was possible. And it's been, you know, I became minister towards the end of the pandemic, so I've been lucky to see how that funding has helped people get back on their feet, but also to see the changed ways of working. You know, for a time when people weren't able to visit in person, it encouraged people to do more digitally, to share things with worldwide audiences, and that sort of hybrid model has continued. And again, some of the money that was provided through the Cultural Recovery Fund has helped people invest in that. And that's an important part of sharing our heritage with audiences, you know, some of whom may not physically be able to visit sites as easily as others.
One other strand that's been in the media of recent years is the idea that this relationship between heritage and politics. I wanted to get your take on whether you think that the heritage sector and heritage organisations have become too politicised recently.
Well, I think, I'm a history graduate. I think it's great that people are debating the past, and that is a never-ending process. You know, there's no final word on history. We should always be re-examining and questioning what has come before. We should be always asking the question, well, whose story isn't being heard here? What's the counterpoint to this argument? So I think, you know, there's a very close overlap between history and politics. You know, history is you know, trying to understand the nature of human relations in different eras and civilizations, and sheds important light on current debates. So I welcome it. I think the important thing is that it's done in a rigorous way, a scholarly way. Museums and galleries and heritage venues should be provoking debate. The important thing is that encourage people to ask the questions, and they don't spoon feed them the answers. You let visitors and the people that come to see your collections, let them make their own minds up, give them the facts, maybe even send them away with more questions in their mind. You know, encourage them to do some more research, to pick up a book, to go on Wikipedia, to, you know, to join the debate. That's an important part of it. It's a never-ending process.
Some historians have expressed a view in recent years that the government shouldn't necessarily be wading in to the extent that it maybe has into these kind of issues. What would you say in response to those concerns?
Well, you know, we don't have an official view of history. You know, that's not the sort of country we are. We have a rigorous and open debate. I think there's a role for government through things like the laws on making sure that our national collections are protected. I think that is important because it ensures that as, you know, contemporary debates are happening, that there is a long-term view. I think it's important to inject nuance and rigor into the process. Things are never sort of simple yes or no, good and bad. And one of the things I have tried to do when we've had the debates is put that nuance in, because that's the job of a historian. It's complex. There are no easy answers, and people just want to know that there's that rigor, that scholarship, that nuance in the debate. But, you know, that's also coming across very clearly from public historians, from museums and galleries who are trying to do the same as well. So often, you know, frustratingly, the headlines that people see, you know, covering some of these items make it sound like the debate is being waged in a much more simplistic way than actually it is. Most of the people engaged in it are just trying to provoke discussion and inquiry, and that's exactly what they should be doing.
Another subject which is incredibly complex and I suspect needs some of the nuance that you just talked about is the issue of repatriation. What's your view on artefacts that have been originally taken from other cultures elsewhere in the world and are now in this country in the UK?
Well, I think it has to be done case by case. Often there's a complex story behind it, and, you know, that provokes lots of questions, as it should. We, working with the Arts Council, we published some refreshed guidance for museums and galleries and others who are looking at this question. And again, there's no set outcome. I've spoken to lots of curators and museum directors who have talked me through all the possible outcomes. Sometimes, you know, you can have a fruitful loan arrangement. Sometimes you transfer the legal title of an item, but they physically stay in your collection, but the ownership is transferred. Sometimes there are a number of different groups of people who have competing claims on items, and it's just very difficult to disaggregate that today. So you sort of reach a dead end there. And in some cases, as I say, the law says a number of our national institutions are, you know, prohibited in law from deaccessioning their items. But that doesn't stop them lending them, as they generously do to lots of organisations. I think the important thing is that wherever you see an item, and, you know, in a sense, the question of where you see it matters less than what you take from it, because so many of our great institutions are visited by people from around the world. Because of the ability to share things digitally, they can share those with international audiences. The important thing is that they tell the full story. So it's, you know, here's who made it, here's who owned it, here's how it was taken, where it was taken from, how it got here, how it's been looked after since. The many stages of its history down the centuries should all be there for people to engage with. And I think that's, you know, that's as important really as where physically items are located.
It's a slightly different issue, but related, I suppose. Is there any news of when the Bayeux tapestry might go on display in the UK?
Well, actually, I had the pleasure of meeting my French counterpart on a visit to Paris recently, and we're obviously preparing for the UK-France summit later this month, which Prime Minister and President Macron will go to, and Lucy Fraser, our Secretary of State, will go to as well. That follows on from the visit that President Macron made to the UK in, was it 2017, when he generously raised the prospect of a loan of the Bayeux tapestry. We're still very keen. There are a lot of museums in the UK that are very keen to be part of it. It's a very fragile item, as you might expect, so I think there's some important conservation work that's got to be done. I was explaining to the French government that, you know, our conservators and curators and tapestry experts here are very happy to help on that while it's going on, so that we can work out a good time for it to come across the channel. And, you know, it is such a fascinating piece. I mean, there's, you know, some sort of scholarship that suggests it was made in England rather than in France. The you know, this sort of this question of whether the arrow that you know, sort of famously there was added in later. So there's still so much we can learn from it, and yeah, we're keen to see it come to the UK, but I think it needs a bit of love and attention before it can.
Finally, you're obviously hugely interested in history, and although I suspect you don't have the time for this right now, if you had to write a history book on an aspect of history, which would you choose?
Well, I have written, it's very, very niche. I wrote a history of the Cambridge Union, the debating society. As I spent most of my time at university doing debating and student politics and not enough time doing my degree. So after I graduated, I sort of tried to make amends for that by writing a history of the Cambridge Union. Pretty niche area, but it was really fascinating because it's founded in sort of 1815 and it's been a sort of bastion of free speech, but sort of, you know, at that time of the Napoleonic Wars, of a really sort of fascinating climate for undergraduates to be debating contemporary issues. I, for a decade, ran the Conservative History Group, which, as the name suggests, is focused on sort of political history on the centre-right, and have been written lots of pieces and articles along the way. One on a wonderful lady called Mavis Tate, one of the early female MPs, who was also part of the delegation from Parliament to the concentration camps after the Second World War. There was a cross-party, cross-house delegation sent to go and report on it, and the horrific scenes that she saw there at the end of the Second World War very sadly contributed to her mental breakdown, and that and a divorce, it seems, led her to take her own life just a few years later. So it's a really sad story about this incredible sort of pioneering female MP. So I've I continue to I love you know, flicking through the Dictionary of National Biography and Wikipedia, and thinking of more niche topics to write maybe after I'm finished in government.
That was Lord Parkinson, the current Parliamentary Undersecretary of State for Arts and Heritage in the UK. Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Brittany Colley.